Well, good morning, everyone. Welcome to the court. We have two cases today. Our first case is United States versus Chaffron. Lieutenant Cook, are you prepared to argue on behalf of appellant?
Yes, sir.
Lieutenant Ulan, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, sir.
Very well, then. Please proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court. My name is Lieutenant Ben Cook, and along with Lieutenant Commander Bradley and Mr. Cave, I represent the appellant, Petty Officer Andrew Chaffron. Chief Judge Olson, I respectfully request 3 minutes in rebuttal.
Granted.
An unenumerated Article 134 specification, quote, must have words of criminality, end quote. The terminal element alone does not import words of criminality into the specification. This court should set aside appellant's conviction for three reasons. First, the specification lacked words of criminality and was therefore deficient. Second, the conduct at issue is not in and of itself a crime and did not therefore necessarily imply criminality. And third, this allowed the government to lower its burden of proof at trial, prejudicing appellant.
Lieutenant Cook, this is a fascinating area of the law, but before we get to that aspect of it, I'd like to ask you a dry, tedious question.
Yes, sir.
And that has to do with the standard of prejudice. So in your brief, you argue that the burden is on the government. If this court were to get to the issue of prejudice, the burden would be on the government to prove that it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. You argue that. The government says no, it really needs to be a situation where it involves the typical resulted in material prejudice to the accused. Why is your approach the correct one?
Your Honor, because the error at issue is a Sixth Amendment fair notice as to the standard applicable to the forbidden conduct issue. It's a notice issue that goes to the constitutionality of whether the accused, the appellant, had notice as to the elements against which he needed to defend, and that's why it should be a harmless beyond a reasonable doubt analysis.
How is it distinguishable from Humphreys?
I don't have an answer for that.
Okay.
So, when the court is looking at the fair notice issue, there are two sort of concepts in play. One is the Fifth Amendment issue of fair notice that, in general, an action is forbidden and subject to criminal sanction. Here, we're looking at the Sixth Amendment issue of fair notice as to the standard applicable to the forbidden conduct. And what the court said in Vaughan is that for an unenumerated Article 134 specification, that words of criminality must be pled to provide the contours of the law, the legal standard that is in play. And the issue here is it had no words of criminality, and so there's a question. What was appellant charged with? What was he defending against? And on the one hand, in the litigation at the lower court, there's this idea of, well, ultimately he was charged with this Virginia statute in play, and that's what the government argued, that's part of the lower court's holding. But there are several problems with that. One, that statute, like many of the majority of state statutes in play for this type of conduct, has numerous exceptions, therefore requiring to plead wrongful or unlawful to put on notice of potential defenses. And two, that statute has a different mens rea from that which appellant was apparently charged and convicted of. That statute, as appellant raised at trial, has a knowledge mens rea, and when the government excised knowledge from the original specification and said, no, under Alonis and Tucker, we would like to charge recklessness, and appellant objected, appellant pointed out, well, the Virginia statute that would otherwise be in play in the state of Virginia, in the Commonwealth of Virginia, has this mens rea of knowledge that you originally charged.
So, counsel, this would all make sense to me if this was charged under Clause 3, but we don't have a Clause 3 offense here, right? We have a Clause 1 and 2 offense. And your arguments would make sense to me if we still lived in the era of Foster and Sapp, where military justice didn't treat the terminal elements like real elements. They didn't have to be pled. they didn't have to be proven. They were just assumed to be part of all the enumerated offenses, and even a Clause 3 offense. But we don't live in that era anymore. Now we treat, I mean, you can take exception, I do, with how we treat Clause 2, but we treat Clause 1 and 2 like real elements that have to be pled, they have to be proven. Why aren't those sufficient to put the appellant on notice that his behavior, whatever that behavior was, if it violates Clause 1 or if it violates Clause 2, that he can be criminally sanctioned by the military?
The separation between the act or the crime and the terminal element, I think first you look to Fossler and Ballin, which explain that these are separate and distinct, where the terminal element must be separately charged, put to the members, and proven beyond a reasonable doubt. When you're looking at the first element of 134 with the act, it sort of starts with Parker v. Levy, which looks at that fair notice Fifth Amendment issue of, is this act something somebody has criminal notice of? Not as much of an issue here, but then you look to really to Davis. And it, sort of the synthesis of the case law is there's sort of several baskets something can be in. There, on the one hand, you have this unwritten customary military law. That's what Parker v. Levy and Davis are really looking at. Do the words of that act express a crime, as Bryce says, in and of itself a crime, in that case under military law? In a case like Turner, which was not a 134 case but was sort of similar at the lack of the word unlawfully, there you're looking at an act that is a malum in se. It is in and of itself, it is a crime.
But don't Parker v. Levy and Davis, they both recognize there's a category of conduct that not only would not be criminal in a civilian context, it could not be criminal in a civilian context, but it is criminal in the military context because it is either prejudicial to good order or it's service discrediting, and for no other reason than those reasons alone.
So the difference with the conduct here, Your Honor, is with the cases like where you get less tethered to a military-specific issue like in Davis, there, like the court looked at in Vaughn, in Saunders, or in Sadler, is an offense that is a malum prohibitum. It's something that some competent authority has prescribed that you can't do. That authority is not the military. So it looks at what the court said in Vaughn in analyzing the specification of their child neglect. Does it, quote, capture the essence? And that's where the criminality of the act is found, the contours of the law, what the fair notice as to the standard applicable to the forbidden conduct, whether that's the mens rea, whether that's other functions words of criminality do, separating lawful from unlawful, providing notice of potential defenses or exceptions, or just providing the standard. So in the conduct at issue here, the standard is what authority in that place for those people has set a legal drinking age, what is the mens rea, what are the potential defenses or exceptions. That's what the law under Vaughn, under Saunders, would require to be pled for this offense. If you take it back to you did X, sailor or Marine Coast Guardsman, and then the terminal element, it sort of makes the rest of that analysis of the law for this kind of conduct that is not under customary military law, unwritten or by regulation a crime. It alleviates the need to do any of that analysis. And that type of analysis is
what
we're
saying. But how do we know? Right?
No, go ahead.
Well, how do we know, right? I mean, like when I teach my students about Article 134 and I'm introducing to them, I say it has two elements, right? You did or didn't do something, and that thing you did or didn't do was either prejudicial to good order or it was service discrediting. I mean, excluding Clause 3, right? I don't then have to teach them like, well, there's things that are historically, you know, they were military crimes. I think there's no more explanation beyond that. Just you did or didn't do something, and then what you did or didn't do was prejudicial to good order or service discrediting, period. Like, what am I misleading them? Like, what more, how do we know there's anything more into it than that? Like, where does an additional requirement beyond just the satisfying of those two elements come from?
Your Honor, it comes from Vaughn. The analysis in Vaughn looked at The first analysis was the Fifth Amendment fair notice analysis, and the second analysis was, quote, the sufficiency of the specification, did it provide a standard applicable to the forbidden conduct? And it analyzed, and again, it's important to remember that Vaughn, Brachin, most of the cases that looked at these are guilty pleas with providence inquiries, but Vaughn looked at, do the words expressed in the specification capture the essence of child neglect? And it you know, there wasn't the, quote, magic word of wrongfully or unlawfully, but it found that those words expressed this crime as it is reflected in a majority of state statutes.
But didn't all those concerns kind of go away when we had this sort of fundamental sea change in how we treat Article 134? Like, all of these concerns were on the table when Clause 1 and Clause 2 were just presumed to be part of every enumerated offense. And so we allowed, the military justice allowed, the government to include Article 134 as a lesser included offense of all the other offenses. They allowed the government to charge Article 134 without ever informing the defendant which of the clauses they'd violated or without offering any evidence, to prove the terminal element. And so we lived in a world where it was completely uncertain, right? But this court in 2008 to 2011 timeframe put a stop to end all of that, right? And now we live in a new regime where we actually have to plead and prove the terminal elements. Why isn't that enough? Like, in this case, for example, why isn't it enough that providing alcohol to minors was either prejudicial to good order or it was service discrediting? What more is necessary?
Your Honor, I think the answer is from the court's cases in that sea change. So what Fossler says and what Bowers enforces is that these legal concepts are separate and distinct. Words of criminality do not imply the terminal element. And as Ballin says, the terminal element needs to be separately charged, needs to be put to the members. And so they're separate and distinct.
And counsel, I go along with that. I want to go back to something that you said because, and this is a follow-on to Judge Hardy's question. Are you considering this a Davis 1 or Davis 2 category? That whether Davis 1 being conduct that is generally recognized as illegal under the common law or under most statutory criminal codes, and then category 2 Davis is conduct viewed as illegal purely within the military, because you seem to be arguing that this is a Davis 2 offense.
No, Your Honor. So, and the court's case in Gifford, 2016, actually helps explain why it's not. So,
oh no, I'm not saying it's a category two. It's from your argument that was the sense I was getting, and I think that was partly what was prompting Judge Hardy's question.
No, Your Honor. To the contrary, this underlying offense, as the court said in Gifford, is not ultra hazardous or a dangerous activity. It's not a strict liability offense, and it's
is it illegal under common law or under most statutory criminal codes? I mean, the CCA opinion does an excellent job in laying out how many states prohibited, providing alcoholic beverages to people under 21, and so. Are you considering this a Davis 1 offense?
It's more of a Davis 1 offense, which uses the phrase generally recognized. Again, that gets more to the concept of, in general, did somebody have fair notice that they could be subject to criminal sanction? That's not the issue in this case. The difference is that if it's not unwritten customary military law, like sort of Parker v. Levy Davis offenses specific to the military, which this is not, and the footnote in Gifford, footnote 7, explains that the military itself allows this kind of conduct in certain circumstances. So it is not an unwritten sort of military core prohibition. If it's something that states have and can criminalize, that's 51 of them do, goes to that first fair notice issue of subject to criminal sanction. Perhaps, yes, there is notice that in general this can be criminalized. But as to the elements against which the accused must be able to fashion a defense, that's where those 50 states, where the majority of them have exceptions, where they have different mens reas, which is the prejudice that we see here, where the
Counsel, speaking of the prejudice, can we go back to Chief Judge Olson's question? And let me ask this first as a predicate to that. If the specification had said, had concluded the word wrongfully, would it have been sufficient in your view?
It would have still lacked a mens rea, Your Honor.
So recklessly and wrongfully?
Yes, Your Honor.
What would have been different then in this trial? So let's assume you're right that the specification was deficient because it didn't say recklessly and wrongfully or some other words like that, equivalent. What was the prejudice? What would have been different at this trial? I mean, conceding there was an error, why was the error harmless? I mean, wouldn't the proof and everything else have just been the same? Didn't the government prove it was reckless? How would you have defended on the wrongfulness? I mean, what would have been different?
Your Honor, first, this is the — to defend against the wrongful, the accused needs fair notice as to the standard or the applicable law that is or is not wrongful. So,
but the question is, would you have possibly said that would have made this not wrongful under any standards? I mean, what was the justification for not being wrongful?
So, as an example, Your Honor, one of the sources of law that the government defends the specification on is a Coast Guard instruction. Oh, well, customary military law, look, there's a Coast Guard instruction. Well, that Coast Guard instruction very specifically does not cover this conduct. The appellant would have been not guilty under that. Under the Virginia statute, there are seven exceptions. The lower court focused on, well, ultimately, he probably wouldn't have met one of those exceptions. But that can't be the statute that he was charged with because that statute has a higher...
But you're not saying he has to be charged under statute. You're just saying we had to put the word wrongfully in the specification, and then it would have been okay. And I'm just having difficulty seeing how that would have made a difference. I mean, if they had charged this as wrongfully, what would the government have had to prove differently from what it proved?
So if they charged it as wrongfully, Your Honor, the government, it would have alerted the defense to the potential for exceptions or justifications. And
I've got that, and we got an error. But what would have been different? What defense would you have brought up?
The defense could have then, after being told, no, you're not being charged with the Virginia statute, and, Your Honor, I see I'm...
Please proceed.
You're not being charged with the Virginia statute. You're being charged with the lower one. It would have put the defense on notice then to file a bill of particulars or perhaps during trial file a 917 motion to say, well, I wasn't charged with that crime. So what crime, what standard applicable to the forbidden conduct am I being charged with? If it's not Virginia and it's not customary military law and it's not a Coast Guard instruction, what are my defenses? What standard am I being charged under? And
But counsel, that was sorted out. I mean, a motion was filed, the parties agreed. Reckless was the standard after the specification was amended by the government. I'm not sure where you're saying what standard and is applicable. It was all agreed the standard was reckless after it was amended. And defense did come forward and challenge the original specification.
Yes, Your Honor, and after that occurred, the defense was then on notice that the legal age of drinking age coming from the Commonwealth of Virginia, that's not the prohibition you're being charged with. So then the accused is being charged with essentially a selected mens rea from Tucker and Alonis and no other standard applicable to the forbidden conduct, even if there was the best defense in the world, he couldn't even raise it. It wasn't possible to raise it. It therefore lowered the government's burden of proof. They never had to prove that any standard existed, let alone that the accused violated it wrongfully.
Counsel, aren't you at a bit of a disadvantage by this whole situation where the specification on the grounds you're putting forth today was not challenged at trial? And on appeal, when it's, I think our case law is that when we get to this point, we view the alleged defect or defective specification for maximum liberality. Isn't that, how do you get around that? I mean, or do you not? But at least do you accept that that's a disadvantage for you at this point? In other words, we're now looking at what the trial defense counsel did or didn't do They apparently thought that they were on notice and proceeded to trial with their defense. And there's no allegation here that they were ineffective for proceeding that way. So isn't that a disadvantage for you?
In
as far as notice is concerned, they appear to have been on notice.
In their defense, Your Honor, they did object to the switching of the mens rea and expressed confusion as to if the government was charging the Virginia statute and now specifically asking for a lower one, they shouldn't be allowed to do that. And so they were sort of told that it wasn't the Virginia statute by virtue of that. To answer your question about the standard of review, yes, they did not make this objection at trial, and the standard of review is viewed with more maximum liberality. I think still when the court has done that in Brechin, in Turner, it has still looked to other words in the specification that are not there. In Turner, it was still attempt to kill with premeditation. It's in and of itself, that's a crime. And then the analysis in Brechin at the other words in that specification and in Vaughan as well, still there's less and really nothing else in the specification compared to the cases where the court applied that standard, Your Honor.
I guess I'm still stuck on your claim that the defense at trial was not on notice or they were not allowed to present certain defenses, and I just don't. I mean, they're just as smart as you are, aren't they?
Probably smarter, Your Honor. So if it is unclear ultimately what standard and really what law and what authority the accused was convicted of now, it follows that they didn't know what they were defending against at trial.
I don't know if that follows at all. I mean, unless you're alleging they were ineffective.
No, I think they, Your Honor, were initially charged with what sort of looked like the Virginia statute, were then told it's not that, it's a lower mens rea, and then the words in the specification charged a per se crime for which there were no defenses, and they did their best to defend against that. The problem is that offense only exists in this charge sheet. It's not how it looks in Virginia. It's not how it looks in the majority of other states.
Why is that relevant, how it looks in Virginia? I mean, there are lots of ways, lots of conduct that can be criminalized or prosecuted in the military that don't have anything to do with being a crime in the outside world.
And as the court said in Bryce, where
are we only concerned about what conduct has been pleaded and what conduct has been proved under Article 134 along with the terminal elements?
As the court said in Bryce, when it's an unenumerated offense, it's not listed in the code and it's not in and of itself criminal, the words of criminality there are required to provide notice as to what the accused is.
But are we so formalistic that if the defense does not feel that that's the problem for them, do we then go back in retrospect on appeal and give some kind of relief when, in fact, the defense defended on every basis they thought they needed to?
Your Honor, in most of the cases that this Court has ruled on this issue were guilty pleas with providence inquiries, and I think this error and the line of Coast Guard cases that allows essentially to just import the terminal element and alleviate any of the concerns that were looked at in Vaughan and in Saunders, they show the need for a bright-line rule, just as the Court gave in Vaughan and just like the President has given, that if you're untethered from any code or any customary law, you need to provide the legal standard and the criminality. I think this case reflects the difficulty and the confusion when that's not done, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you.
Further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Lieutenant Cook.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson and judges of the court. And may it please the court, I'm Lieutenant Elizabeth Yulin, and with Lieutenant Christopher Hammersky, we represent the United States. This court should affirm the Coast Guard Court's decision for two reasons. First, charge to states an offense as it expressly alleges all the elements of an Article 134 offense and necessarily implies criminality. And second, there is no substantial prejudice here. The specification is not so obviously defective that by no reasonable construction can it be said to fail to state the offense for which appellant was convicted. There is nothing in the record to suggest that appellant would have changed his defense or could have changed his defense in any way had wrongfully been alleged. As appellant did not object at trial that charge 2 was defective because it fails to state an offense, the specification is viewed with greater tolerance and maximum liberality. The specification of charge 2 alleges all of the necessary elements of an Article 134 offense. Specifically, an Article 134 offense needs to contain a predicate act or a failure to act in the terminal element.
Counsel, on that point, that's what the manual says. But if you look at the language of Clause 1, it talks about a disorder or neglect that contributes to the that's contrary to good order and discipline. And so even though the manual lists the elements as any act that's contrary to good order and discipline, if you look at the language of Clause 1, it says disorders and neglects. Doesn't it have to be a disorder and neglect? And if so, what is a disorder and neglect?
Your Honor, for this offense, as shown through case law and state law, providing alcohol to someone under the age of 21 is widely known as being prohibited. Although there's not a specific military order that prohibits
it. Let me ask this question. Suppose the appellant had provided, he had a party at his house, and he provided alcohol to people who were over 21, and they were junior and senior enlisted, and they got into quarrels and arguments, and they all had too much to drink. And so there was clear effect on good order, but providing alcohol to people who are over 21 is not a disorder or neglect. It's perfectly lawful. Would that be okay? To charge as 134, that he provided alcohol in a situation where they were senior and junior enlisted and it caused a harm to disorder?
Your Honor, based off of this court's case law, particularly looking at Davis, where the offense was cross-dressing, potentially, yes, the military could charge that if the facts of the case showed that it was against good order and discipline. So there is case law that shows where the military has charged offenses that aren't necessarily illegal in the civilian civilian setting, but it is in a military setting because of its effect on good order and discipline or its service discrediting. As stated, 134 specification requires that there is a predicate act or failure to act in the terminal element. Here, the government charged that Ms. Person under the age of 21 was provided alcohol by the appellant and that it violated Clause 1 and 2 of the terminal element. Additionally, specific words of criminality aren't required in the specification as the appellant alleges here. Neither the statutory text nor the MCM contains a requirement that the word unlawful or wrongfully be included in the specification. Instead, the MCM discusses words indicating criminality, stating they should be used when the alleged act is not in and of itself an offense. Here, all of the alleged acts, looking at our military case law as well as state law, are generally prescribed, making specific words of criminality like wrongful or unlawful unnecessary.
So you say generally prescribed. When does it become generally prescribed? When will a service member know?
Your Honor, similar to this case, they would know, one, looking at they could look at the factors in Vaughan. So Vaughan talks about looking at sources of case law, military regulations, as well as the laws across the state or federal laws. So in instances, but
local laws, various service laws or regulations, they have different standards and different exceptions. It's not a blanket prohibition. So why isn't this going to be an area where an accused and the accused counsel aren't going to be confused by this. Why is it such a burden for the government to put in something having to do with either the scienter requirement, putting in words of mens rea, or citing words such as prohibited or citing a specific regulation or statute?
Your Honor, although it's not a burden for the government to do that, and in this case, the recklessness was not, the mens rea wasn't specifically in the specification, but all of the parties understood and tried the case as if recklessness was the mens rea here. However, as our lower court stated, the specifications are not required to exclude any possibility of innocence. And here the general prohibition is that you should not provide alcohol to someone under the age of 21. Our lower court cited to a Supreme Court case law, McKelvey and Sisson, for the premise that indictments don't need to it is incumbent on the one who relies on such exception to set up and establish the standard, and that the indictment that recites the necessary elements of an offense is not insufficient because it does not allege facts that themselves demonstrate the availability of a constitutional privilege. Additionally, turning to prejudice, even if...
So before you get into prejudice,
yes, Your Honor.
I just want to make sure I understand the government's position. Sometimes you're defending this on the narrow grounds of this case, well, they knew what the standard was and so forth. What about the general proposition? What does the government want this court to hold in terms of the ability for prosecutor, trial counsel to use Article 134? Is it simply spelling out you did this act or you failed to do this act and it was prejudicial to good order and discipline? Is that sufficient in all instances? All instances.
No, Your Honor. The government would... What's position is that when words of criminality or when more specificity is required depends on the nature of the offense. And in some instances, in order to put the appellant on notice of why the government is alleging something is against good order and discipline or service discrediting, potentially more information would be required in the specification. So providing more facts to show why they're alleging that it is service discrediting or against good order and discipline.
How is a reviewing court supposed to know when, in what instances is it required?
Your Honor, I think this case is a good example of when more specificity wouldn't be required.
Would or would not?
Would not. Sorry, Your Honor. Would not be required. So when something is generally prohibited, would be an instance where more specificity wouldn't be needed.
And this would be a legal requirement.
Sorry, Your Honor, can you...
We would then have to look at every Article 134 specification that didn't have something like words of criminality or mens rea added to it, and then determine, it would be subject to review as to whether in that particular instance the additional the additional wordage would have been necessary. Is that the rule the government is asking for?
Your Honor, it would be inherently with the nature of an unenumerated Article 134 offense. Yes, Your Honor, it would require looking at each individual case to determine if the charge was appropriate for what the government alleged.
And what is the standard that we review? Do we just review the specification and decide whether a particular appellant before us had fair notice based on that particular charge, that particular conduct was unlawful?
Your Honor, the court would look to whether or not there was sufficient notice for what they had to defend against, specifically that notice piece to see if they were aware of that, which turning to prejudice here would not – he clearly did have notice of what he had to defend against based off of the way that the defense counsel tried the case here.
So it goes back to my point is if the government is not taking an absolutist position that the government can simply say service member A took this action or failed to take this action and it was service discrediting, but instead there needs to be some analysis of whether it was, as you put it, generally prohibited. When we have an instance like this, where there are a number of exceptions to when alcohol can be provided to someone who's under 21, where does that leave us? What if a clergy member is giving communion to someone who is 18 years old?
Your Honor, if that's the case, the defense is not precluded from still raising that as a defense, saying that because they were a clergy member and providing alcohol, that shows that that wasn't either just service discrediting or against good order and discipline, depending on which
I mean, what kind
alleged.
Of defense is it? I mean, are we just asking for jury nullification because we don't think chaplains should be punished that way? Or are we citing something? Or we're just going to say, well, I mean, the police here in this state don't generally go around rounding up the local priests and pastors, so it's probably not unlawful, actually. So, I mean, we're sort of grasping it. Well, what is the standard? How do we review this? I mean, we need a rule.
Your Honor, as stated, the government would purport that the rule the court should put forward is that if the conduct is generally recognized as prohibited here, then specific words like criminality or unwrongful wouldn't be necessary. But if the act itself is generally not a crime, then more specificity in the specification would be required, either potentially using wrongful or unlawful, that may be sufficient, or they would need to allege more details to describe why the conduct was lawful or wrongful.
Is it possible that a chaplain providing communion wine to an 18-year-old is neither service discrediting nor prejudicial to good order and discipline?
Your Honor, I think that would depend on the facts of that specific case. Potentially, there could be a situation where that could violate prejudicial good order and discipline and be potentially service discrediting. Turning to prejudice here, the record shows appellant was aware his conduct was prohibited, and based on appellant's trial strategy, he was sufficiently apprised of what he had to defend against. When a claim for failure to state an offense is first raised after trial, the claim will fail absent a clear showing of substantial prejudice to the accused, such as a showing that the indictment is so obviously defective that by no reasonable construction can it be said to charge an offense. Without a showing of prejudice, a conviction will not be reversed when the specification is only challenged after conviction. Here, the questions at trial show appellant was aware that providing alcohol to someone under 21 was prohibited. Specifically, the defense counsel asked the victim, "You did not tell him that you were not legally old enough to drink," which she responded, "No." And defense counsel followed up, "In fact, you told him that you were 21," which she said no to. Additionally, trial counsel asked the victim, "Did you ever tell him that you were 20? Which she said yes. And then trial counsel continued and said, was that just what was on your Tinder profile, or was there a separate conversation about it?" Said that it was on her Tinder profile, and she mentioned it as the reason why she wouldn't drink. Additionally, trial counsel asked her, did the fact that she was 20 years old affect her decision when driving that night? Which she responded, "Yes, I didn't want to leave until I felt like I was sober, and I didn't like the idea of drinking underage." Additionally, during the testimony of appellant's roommate, defense counsel asked the roommate if he was 21, which he answered yes, and then continued and said, "Just in general terms, both of you drink alcohol, have alcohol in your house if you are of age," which he responded yes, and then additionally followed up and said, "Are you aware of any laws that make it impermissible to have alcohol in your house if you are of age?" which he responded no. That continued with defense counsel saying, "Did you believe it was okay for you to have alcohol in your house?" which he responded, "Absolutely, because you're 21, which he responded yes to. All of this shows that trial counsel was aware of the standard. the emphasis on legal drinking age and legally old enough in during the testimony as well shows that the language in the specification necessarily implied that appellant's conduct was illegal.
Counsel, on that, please go
ahead. This will be short. Because you're saying trial counsel. I think you're meaning trial defense counsel. Because the argument would be defense counsel was aware, i.e., the appellant was aware what the standard. I think it was just a misslip of words, but I don't.
Yes, sir. I was going in and out between defense counsel and trial counsel's testimony, but you're correct. I was trying to focus more on defense counsel's testimony as well, while also pointing out other instances in the record where it was clear what the standard was. My apologies.
Counsel, on the issue of prejudice, I asked counsel for the appellant what difference it would make if the specification had included the word wrongfully. And as I understood the answer, and I don't want to put words in the appellant's mouth, but as I understood it, that without the word wrongfully, there really wasn't any room to bring up anything other than that she wasn't 21, that there was, as the specification was charged, appellant's word was it was sort of strict liability such that they couldn't bring up any exception because the language of the statute didn't specify any exception. And in addition, because it didn't say wrongfully, he couldn't even ask what the exceptions might be. He didn't know what the exceptions might be. Could you respond to that argument with respect to prejudice?
Yes, Your Honor. So even if wrongfully had been alleged in the specification, assuming that it was required, there would have been no difference, Your Honor, particularly because in this case, none of the exceptions do apply here. The facts show that the only exception that the government can think that could possibly apply was potentially her parent was there and allowed the appellant to provide her alcohol, which isn't the case here. The only individuals present were the appellant, Ms. and appellant's roommate. Additionally, at trial, defense did vigorously defend against this charge. Not only did they go after the fact that not only did they claim that he didn't know her age, but they also attacked her credibility as a witness. They attacked whether or not there was even alcohol present. They also attacked whether or not he provided her alcohol or if it was his roommate that provided her alcohol. So they did raise a myriad of different defenses that were not just tied to her age.
Can I ask another question about generally prescribed? We have in general, providing alcohol to someone under 21 is a crime, but there are some exceptions. What do we mean by generally prescribed? More often than not, that's criminal? How would we assess what's generally prescribed? How many exceptions is enough to make it not generally prescribed? How frequently must those exceptions come up to make it not generally prescribed?
Your Honor, as is the case here, when law or looking at case law as well states that the starting place is providing alcohol to someone under 21 is prohibited. As the lower court stated and the government agrees with, the government is not required to ensure that every exception is captured in the specification itself, and not putting the word wrongfully in it didn't prevent appellant from raising any of those exceptions if they felt that it was possible to make that argument specifically because it could potentially negate good order and discipline or the service discrediting terminal elements. If the panel agreed that because that conduct fell within an exception, it didn't ruin the reputation of the service or it didn't harm good order and discipline. Your Honor, pending any questions, may I briefly conclude?
Any questions? Seeing none, thank you, Lieutenant Yula.
For the foregoing reasons, this court should affirm. Thank you.
Lieutenant Cook.
On prejudice, so in Humphreys, where the terminal element was not charged, the court applied harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. But there, the evidence had been introduced on the terminal element at trial, and the military judge's instructions were correct. And sort of similarly in Turner, where the court applied harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, there the court listed in bullet point format seven different times, four of which were either pretrial or right at the beginning of trial during voir dire, that the defense clearly knew what was being charged, that it was unlawful murder. And here it's different. So here there are the judges, military judges' instructions were incorrect. They imported an element, part of an element of criminality that was not pled, for which there was no evidence introduced at trial, and which was never identified for the defense. And so that's the difference in Humphreys, is evidence at trial and the instruction. And the difference in Turner is, you know, as the government read a number of lines from the trial record, it really all boils down to that one cross-examination question of did you ever tell him you weren't legally old enough to drink? That is one question in the middle of a cross-examination that really went to the little bit that the defense did have notice of recklessness. It's really just about that. When compared to the litany of examples in Turner, it pales in comparison to that. And Judge Maggs, just to sort of get back to the question of what would have gone differently if wrongful and reckless had been pled. Again, there the problem is, as the government just said in arguing to support this conviction, well, ultimately he would have never met one of those seven exceptions in the state of Virginia. And that's the problem, because that is not what was charged. That was not what the accused had noticed he was defending against. In fact, the accused was very specifically told that is not what you're defending against, because that crime in the Commonwealth of Virginia that the military can charge a certain way has a higher mens rea. And when the accused said, knowledge, that's the mens rea I'm being charged with, right? The government said, no, a lower one, recklessness, and the judge denied that opposition to the change. And so even on appeal, 2 years later, the government is explaining, well, there's no prejudice because he would have never met one of those exceptions. But that can't possibly be what he was defending against. And it can't possibly be what he was convicted of, because he had a great defense to that, to the Virginia statute, that he did not meet the mens rea, but the government very specifically didn't charge it. And that reflects the problem here, is even on appeal, it's customary military law. That's in the government's brief at 15. But Gifford says, no, it's not this underlying crime. It's not customary military law. Well, maybe it's the Virginia statute. But he was told at trial it was not. And ultimately what they're left with is, you did X, therefore it violated the terminal element. That's not enough.
Questions? Seeing none, thank you. The case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand in recess until 10:30.
All right. The court stands in recess until 10:30.